order. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2320. And Gina Skinner.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2320 would limit crimes subject to civil compromise. As I explained in my staff measure summary, civil compromise is an alternative disposition to criminal cases where a defendant can enter into an agreement with their victim that can result in a dismissal of the criminal case. Usually it just involves a payment of a sum of money, although some victims will get creative and require counseling or treatment or something of that nature. What this bill would do would take any crime committed against a family member, household member, elderly or disabled person, and say that they cannot be civilly compromised.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association in support of House Bill 2320. As just was briefed to you, currently the civil compromise statute in Oregon allows certain crimes where a victim may choose to get money and basically have a criminal case be dismissed. Currently, the law articulates a couple of specific domestic violence crimes that may not be civil compromised for obvious reasons. We don't want to put victims in a situation where they feel pressured, threatened, or otherwise coerced to accept some payment of money and then have criminal charges dismissed against their abuser. But the problem that has come up is that there has been additional crimes to this list that are not articulated that have also come into the purview of domestic violence, and we've had cases where charges have been civil compromised under those circumstances, and we want to prevent that from occurring. Basically, our position is that once the police are called to a home, that it does become the community's problem. We're not talking about situations between family members where it may be property damage or something where the police are never involved. That's not the situation here. When the police get involved and they come, the police have to have probable cause that a crime has been committed. They make an arrest. It gets reviewed by a district attorney who then files criminal charges for any kind of crime against that family member. Obviously, there's bigger problems here, whether it's violence, mental health issues, drug abuse, methamphetamine use. There's something else going in the home that they feel the police must be involved. At that point, the state's position is that any crime that is charged, that the victim should not be allowed to get paid off because, again, of changing their emotions about the situation, feeling sorry for the person, feeling threatened, coerced, or anything else, to then have it go away. We want that. At that point, it's the community's problem, and we want to get involved and require that person, whether it's to do drug treatment or to do anger counseling or mental health counseling or do something to prevent future problems. Even if it is something as simple as not a violent crime, but it's a property crime. Maybe the underlying problem was methamphetamine use, and then a parent against a child or a wife against a husband, and then they want to pay money to make it go away because they don't want anyone to know about it or they just want it to be dismissed. Then later that person goes out and commits multiple other crimes against other people in the community, and we look back and say we could have done something, but these charges were dismissed when the criminal case was pending and open. We could have done something. So we just want to prevent anyone from feeling pressured or threatened or coerced to have these charges dismissed and have any cases between family members not be allowed to be paid off.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the panel? Thank you. Kelly Smiley.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose House Bill 2320 in that what it's going to do is take out of the civil compromise statute some crimes that are more commonly civilly compromised. And the first one that comes to mind is criminal mischief. Somebody damages another person's property intentionally or recklessly. And so, say for instance, we're talking about keying someone's car or smashing a personal item, something like that. This statute is also defined broadly in terms of who it covers. When family members, so we can be talking about brothers. They don't even live together. They get in an argument at a bar, and one of them breaks the rearview mirror on their car. So the family members don't even have to be living together. They can be adults. And household members, then again, don't need to be family members. They can be roommates who get in an argument and someone marries another person's property. My point being that it's pretty broad, and when we're talking about things like property damage, people get angry, people make mistakes. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's always the root of a bigger problem. And the great thing about a civil compromise statute is that the victim can always say no. The victim has a right to consult with an attorney before deciding whether or not to enter into a civil compromise. In order to be approached regarding a civil compromise, the defense attorney or the defense attorney staff is required to give a victim's rights statement notifying the victim of their right to consult with somebody else. So the victim actually is in control, and we're only talking about situations that don't involve violence. You know, the crimes that are listed here are violent crimes, and they make sense in the arguments of Ms. Skinner that once one of these violent crimes is reported to police, that the police have become involved, and it makes a little bit more sense to limit civil compromise. But in the case of property damage, those that argument is not as strong. People make mistakes. People get angry, bother someone else's property. The good thing about civil compromise, and the thing that people really like, that victims really like about civil compromise, is they get their money up front. They get paid for whatever damages it is that occurred, and they can require anything else they want, a letter of apology. You know, they can require the victim actually come and do the repairs, not only just pay for them, but physically do them. So there are a lot of ways in which a civil compromise is more satisfying for a victim than the actual criminal prosecution. And we think that the current limitations in the statute are adequate.
Okay, questions?
Ms. Chair, Ms. Guy, how common is civil compromise among family member relationships or relationships that would be barred by this statutory change?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I need to first say that I've been a public defender my entire career, so I generally am dealing with people who are indigent, and not a lot of my clients have money to follow through with a civil compromise. So my answer to you may be a little skewed just because of the population that I represent. I don't think it's that common because there aren't a lot of misdemeanor property crimes that are charged between family members. And I think that Ms. Skinner alluded to why that is, and that is that a lot of times when these kind of things happen within a household, the police aren't called because it's not that big of a deal. People get in arguments and break each other's toys. That's not something that the police are called for. However, it's important to keep in mind that the level to which something rises before you would call the police may be different than the level to which something rises before somebody else may call the police. There are people who call the police knowing that they can just punish the other person. Police officer comes, it's between family members, they're required to make a report. Now we've bound them all by these particular laws. So I've strayed a little bit from answering your question, but I would say that it's not super common, but that it happens.
Mr. Actually, I have a question on staff. As I read this House Bill 2320, it's my understanding that the proposal of the bill is to remove, at least from what it appears to me, person crimes to be subject for the compromise issue. Is that correct?
Representative Olson, what it essentially does is it does remove those person crimes from the list, because instead it's saying simply if the defendant is a family or household member upon another family or household member, or the person with elderly or disabilities, you may not civilly compromise it regardless of the crime committed.
So what it was doing is it's adding non-person crimes to the prohibition.
Correct. Correct.
I'd ask you, I can recall cases where people make a civil compromise, usually over a theft kind of thing, and they owe $1,000, and they pay $20, and then they say, I'm not paying anymore. And the person calls the police back and says, he's reneging, and they say, well, that's a civil matter now because you accepted a payment, so go hire a lawyer. And so that's always a difficulty there. I don't know.
Chair Barker, the civil compromise itself involves a dismissal of charges, which only occurs when the civil compromise has been accepted. So the contract is agreed upon, and judges frequently reject these in situations such as Counsel Moad referred to, where the victim wants somebody to get counseling or something like that, and that is a situation where it's hard to enforce the follow-through. In my experience, where it's a monetary amount that needs to be paid, that is paid up front as part of the civil compromise, and the charges aren't dismissed until that amount is paid.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I don't have further questions for Ms. Skye, but actually I would like to question Ms. Skinner if I could, so maybe we could have her come forward.
You can either stay or leave, whatever you need. Does anybody have anything more for Ms. Skye?
Maybe.
Well, we stay there just in case. I'm sure that these are friendly enough folks that they can sit there.
He's checking. We're okay.
Ms. Skinner, I'm just trying to sort out an understanding here. The way the law works now appears to me, if they say it's a theft, son steals the family vehicle and drives off in it. If the police are called, that is, the criminal justice system is brought into the situation, then civil compromise is not available to resolve that issue if this bill is passed. But if we leave the law the way it is, then civil compromise among family members is available, right?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, that's correct. That currently that would be a remedy under the law, and that what the current law is stating, that if it's a family or household member, and that includes whether it's father, son, brothers, sisters, but also husbands, wives, girlfriends, boyfriends, parents of children. So most of the people we're actually dealing with are in intimate sexual relationships. And that's the relationship we're talking about that's defined in 107.705. That currently the list of the, I think, six crimes that are in the bill are the only ones that you cannot civil compromise. Anything else can be civil compromise. And the problem we've come upon is that there's a lot of things you can do to somebody that you're in a relationship with that is, I just previously mentioned, that it does not fall under these six crimes. The ones most recently I was sharing was like interference with making a report, 165.572. That's a crime where it's usually in a domestic violence situation. Someone feels threatened, scared, or may have been assaulted, may not have been, and they feel it's necessary to call the police. They go to call the police to get help, and their abuser pulls the phone cord from the wall. That currently is not covered under the statute, and that is allowed to be civil compromise, and I've had a case where that was civil compromise because victims in those situations then later feel remorse, or feel threatened, or for whatever reason, accept any amount, $1 can civil compromise a case, and then it can go away. So we don't want victims to be in that situation. There are others, even a property crime. You could have a girlfriend, boyfriend, where they are breaking up, and the girlfriend or the boyfriend is the defendant, and they, the example of keying a car was mentioned. They key that other person's car. That's done in anger. That may be part of a stalking type of behavior, and yet a victim in that situation may feel later down the road, they may apologize or, say that they're sorry, or they may threaten them to go to the police, and the defense attorney that's involved with creating the civil compromise paperwork and accepting some amount of money to make it go away, whereas we want to be involved and require that person to do some kind of counseling to prevent them from doing that to their next girlfriend or boyfriend. The other one I can think of is some kind of property crimes, and again, these are situations where police have been brought into the home, which is very rare when you think about family arguments or property that's damaged, and say that there's a child that is using methamphetamine and is acting out, and whether maybe they're stealing money from grandmother, or they're forging checks, or they're destroying personal property or stealing things and selling it for drug money. And yet the family, at that moment, the police gets involved, but then later they're embarrassed, they don't want to follow through, they don't want to go through the court system or whatever it is, and then the actual underlying problem is never dealt with because they can get the money, but once it's a civil case, the criminal charges are dismissed. The court has no authority whatsoever to enforce anything, whether it's them going to counseling, as was mentioned, that victim could ask them to do that, but there's no authority to require that to occur. But if they're on probation with a probation officer, that probation officer can require that they go to their mental health counseling, that they take in prescribed medications, that they take your analysis to make sure they're not using drugs, that they can make sure that they're going to their anger management counseling appointments. And it's a person that they, if the victim is having further problems, the victim can contact the probation officer and, hey, I think he's still using drugs, right? I think that he's still forging grandma's checks. What can we do about it? And the probation officer then has the authority to bring that person in and deal with the situation. But usually once the police are involved, it's beyond a family's ability to deal with it. And that's what we want to avoid.
If I could further, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the definition of family or household member that's cross-referenced here in the bill, and it's pretty broad. Spouses, former spouses, adult persons related by blood, marriage, or adoption, doesn't say within what range of kinship that would be. Persons who are cohabiting or have cohabited with each other. Persons who have been involved in a sexually intimate relationship. Under that D, people who shared an apartment with each other, that was their only connection, would be barred from having civil compromise. So it strikes me that as drafted, it's kind of broad, but I understand that the intent is to get at relationships of vulnerability, where you said it's sort of unequal levels of power.
Bargaining power.
And so the more powerful party can then use the civil compromise process to get rid of otherwise a criminal charge, and I think that's an appropriate kind of thing to get at. It just seems like this is a little too broad for the purpose. Would you be amenable to an amendment that would narrow it down to that kind of relationship?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I completely understand what you're getting at, and I think that the concern that we have is, I would agree with what you're saying. It's just that this statute is one that's actually pulled out of the restraining order statute, and it's a statute that is used. It's the statute that defines a relationship of people that can obtain a restraining order, and it's actually cross-referenced in a number of statutes throughout the criminal code when talking about what is a family household of family member. If you look in just about every statute that talks about family relationships, this is the statute that's referenced. I would be concerned about, I guess, creating a separate statute just for this one particular statute. It's not that those. I understand what you're saying, but I think that we would be then creating sort of a subsection that would only apply to this one statute. That would be confusing to people in the system that are applying this definition universally.
Yeah.
That would be my only concern.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up maybe more a comment than a question. I understand the concern. It is important to maintain sort of coherence to the way the statutory scheme works, but I'd say maybe in those other areas that persons who used to cohabit might be too broad for those other purposes too, and at least we're not sweeping such a broad net here. It seems to me that we use the criminal justice system to get at so many types of misbehavior, some of which it's not very well suited to. And if we have another mechanism for resolving people's differences, which is what civil compromise constitutes, that seems like generally a good thing. And to sweep too broad a net in trying to get at something that I think is, you've made a good case, it's we ought to be getting at situations of vulnerability or unequal power, but this going with as broad a brush here seems troublesome.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I agree with the concept in the sense that what we're aiming at is domestic relationships. Primarily, we're talking about people that are husband and wife, that are boyfriend and girlfriend, or parents that are estranged now that have children together, and situations where, or relationships that have occurred in the past that are continuing some sort of stalking type behavior, and or, you know, parents and children and like vulnerable grandparents. I mean, that also includes the definition of elderly and disabled people that are taken advantage of, and oftentimes by their own family members, whether it's grandchildren or nieces and nephews that are, or whether it's some kind of abuse by neglect or some, or a lot of it's financial. A lot of it is you know, taking over, you know, stealing, whether it's her grandma's medicine and stealing and selling it on the street, or their checks and washing them and forging them on the street. I mean, often those things are, and I guess those examples are actual situations that occur, but they're not something that's contemplated when you're thinking about, well, forgery, gosh, that's such a, you know, a simple property crime, it's not that big a deal. But then when you think about, you know, a grandson using that, a grandson, their grandmother, you know, the grandmother is not in any position to be able to, especially if there's a parent that's not wanting that child to get criminally prosecuted, to be able to be able to defend them, or to be able to stand up for themselves. And I guess what, in those situations, those very broad, extreme situations with the cohabitating people, our position would be that those people would not ever call the police. If they're people that, you know, used to cohabitate together and your college roommate or something, I mean, those are just situations where it just would not, they would never come into the criminal purview. It's because, again, it would have to be such an emergency that someone would feel the need to call 911 and have someone immediately come to their home and take care of a problem that they feel like there's, that their life is in danger. And that's, those are the situations where police actually do get involved. I mean, you know, 90, I'm sure, however many percent of all arguments or other property damage that's done within families are never reported. They're just resolved. And those are the kind of cases that we don't want to be involved in. We only want to get involved where someone felt so at risk of their life that they felt it important to call 911.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
May I respond to that? Chair Barker, members of the committee, to get involved in the criminal justice system does not require a call to 911. I just want to make sure that everybody understands you can call a non-emergency line, you can see a police officer on the street and say, hey, my roommate broke the window in my car. You make a report if you want your insurance to cover for it. If you ever want to have the ability to claim damages for it, you make a report. How many of you have made a criminal report? I know I have, when my car's been broken into. People make reports because they want to be compensated for their damages, which is precisely what this statute allows. So while it does include a lot of people who call 911 because they feel they're in danger, it also includes a lot of people who report it to the police because they want to be compensated, and that's the only way to document the damages, to possibly get someone to investigate it, and to ensure that they will have the legal mechanism to recover their damages.
But, Mr. Chair, may I ask a question? Wouldn't you agree, though, Ms. Guy, that if an arrest is not made, so let's say it's this, I stop the officer on the street and I say, hey, I think my roommate is the one who did this, and I just want it documented because I want my insurance to cover it. So an arrest is not made, and I can't speak for other counties in the state, but at least in Multnomah County, if the DA's office even got that report to review, for a misdemeanor in particular, the victim would have had to come in to sign the complaint. And so there was at least that second level of the victim pursuing that issue. And then if the victim wanted to back off from it, then doesn't that, I mean, conceivably raise the concern that the defendant has exerted some undue influence over the victim?
Chair Barker, Council Moad, what I would say is that in my years as a public defender, there have been many cases where a victim has reported something, not always through 911. They pursue it with the DA's office because many people use the criminal justice system, as Representative McPherson was alluding, they use it as a method to a means to an end. They can't hire a civil lawyer. They're angry that someone has damage their property. They know that they're entitled to compensation, and they know that if they go down to the district attorney's office and sign a complaint, that they are lining themselves up for possible compensation. You know, it may be that they think the person deserves a criminal conviction, and it may be that comes right down to it, they don't want the person to have a criminal conviction. They just want to be compensated. I've had lots of victims come into court and say, this is really all I want. I want a letter of apology, and I want to be compensated for my damages. And it saves the victim coming back to court time and time again. It's something that is used by all kinds of victims, and it's something that should be available for non-person crimes, even for people who fall under the broad definition of 107.75.
Okay. And I just briefly add to that, Chair Barker, is that having worked as a district attorney for 8 years now, it's very common that these kind of cases, as Ms. Moed was alluding to, that the kind of cases that we're talking about adding to this are not mandatory arrest crimes by police. The mandatory arrest statute requires, if this relationship exists, the same definition, 107.705, and if the crime was assault or menacing, the police are required to arrest. But under any other statute, they are not required to arrest. So if the victim does not want to pursue it at that point when the police are involved, they just want to document it, the police are not going to arrest. And then secondarily, even if they were, if it came to the district attorney's office and it was a property crime, that we didn't feel that there was any of these sort of concerns that we have here with coercion or threats or any other bigger problems that the community would benefit from the state being involved, then the district attorney's office most likely is not going to be pursuing criminal charges as well if the victim doesn't want to, those issues don't exist.
I was going to ask, there would be nothing that would prevent the victim from just changing their mind, saying, I don't want to prosecute on this at all anyway, and just walk away from it.
Chair Barker, the district attorney's office does have the authority to basically take over the charges, which is what we do in the majority of all domestic violence cases, and go forward with the criminal charges. But it's the common practice that if it's a property type crime and a victim is not interested in the charge anymore, and we don't feel that there's a community benefit or there's a reason to prosecute, there's a reason that if this person doesn't get on drug treatment or mental health counseling, they're going to further victimize the community, it's a common practice for the district attorney's office to not pursue those charges.
Okay. Further questions?
I have a question. I'm getting an education in an area I knew nothing about. I looked up the statute on the civil compromise itself, ORS 135.705, and it appears to me that it's discretionary with the court to allow the dismissal. So isn't that the right remedy if there, it looks like there's reason to believe that there's an inequality of power in the relationships or something else that's going on to causing the parties to civilly compromise something where really the criminal justice system should apply? Isn't it within the power of the court to say, no, this is a crime against the people generally?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, that is unfortunately applied very disparately as far as certain judges will, you know, will always, a lot of the judges' practice is if both the parties agree that are in the contract for the civil compromise, that they will grant it. The district attorney will often object for certain reasons, and sometimes those are listened to, sometimes they are not. I can't speak for all judges in the state of Oregon, but the judges that I've been in front of that have, this has come up, that oftentimes over the state's objection that the civil compromises are still granted because this has now become a civil contract between this victim and the defendant and the victim of the crime, and the district attorney's office is almost an outsider to that process. And the judge does have the discretion, and most counties have some sort of a policy or practice about when they're allowed and when they're not allowed, but ultimately you're going to have situations where victims are going to be treated differently in different courtrooms or different counties based on how that judge whether agrees or doesn't agree that those kind of influences exist or don't exist, or whether they're relevant to the discussion or not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Discussion? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2330. And let's see. Move on. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3379.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3379 amends ORS 161015 to include parole and probation officers in the definition of peace officers. That definition applies in the section relevant to the use of physical force or deadly physical force.
Brian Lashmet, Lisa Setfell, or like Setfell, and Lucinda Carroll.
Actually, Lisa had to leave. She had another commitment, and I've got two other folks, and
okay.
Maybe we can just make a panel out of it.
That's right. That's fine. Please do.
Go ahead. Yeah, for the record, Brian DeLeishmet here representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers and also the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I'll be extremely brief. This bill came to my attention, and those two organizations introduced this bill to attempt to correct what the parole and probation officers in the state were experiencing as far as their ability to function in their job in some jurisdictions. And as you'll hear, there are some judges that will not allow the function of a parole and probation officer under some functions because of the way the statute is currently written. And with that, I do have one other comment. There has been at least some interest in this bill on the opposing side as to whether or not it somehow changes PERS or these people's qualifications for PERS or anything else. I will assure you that it does not. That issue was taken care of a number of sessions ago in which there was negotiations between those representing parole and probation officers and the jurisdictions. As to those jurisdictions that are not currently in PERS would not be required to come into PERS unless they voluntarily did so, and those that were already in PERS would continue to be in PERS unless there is agreement by the employees. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record right up front. This does not change PERS or any other employment situations. This is purely just a function of the job. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barker, committee representatives. My name is Brennan Mitchell. I'm a parole officer, parole probation officer with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I'm also the president of the Multnomah County chapter of FOPO. I'm here today to ask for your support of House Bill 3379, which would include parole probation officers in the definition of peace officer under ORS 161.015. Parole probation officers supervise a wide range of criminal offenders placed under supervision. These include persons convicted of shoplifting all the way up to murder. Increasingly, due to limited state and local resources, we are primarily supervising persons convicted of serious drug, gang, sex, and assaultive offenses. No longer is our job primarily social work involving the referral of nonviolent offenders to treatment. Today, we are being required by our departments to supervise offenders more intensively than ever. This translates to being out in the community, checking on offenders at their residences, places of work, and where they associate with other persons, many of whom are also criminals. In addition, we also routinely arrest offenders in our offices and out in the community. An arrest situation is the most dangerous aspect of the work that we do. As an illustration of the safety aspects we encounter in our work, I'd like to relate a recent arrest of mine. 2 weeks ago, the mother of a female probationer I supervised contacted me. This probationer was on supervision for manufacture of a controlled substance, methamphetamine, and had absconded supervision. She was using methamphetamine daily and not taking her psychiatric medications for the severe mental illness she suffers from. Her mother stated she had her daughter in the car and was on the way to my office to have her arrested. Her daughter was so strung out on methamphetamine she did not know where her mother was taking her. Long story short, we arrested her outside of my office on the streets of downtown Portland. This probationer resisted arrest both physically and verbally, yelling and screaming, "I'm not going to jail, you're going to have to shoot me." Ultimately, it took 5 probation officers to remove her from her mother's car. During this time, a sizable crowd gathered around the arrest and yelled obscenities and threats at the officers. Additional probation officers had to control a near riot situation of citizens who did not understand or agree with the woman's arrest. The point of this is that I didn't submit this her behavior to the DA for resisting arrest, but we have encountered the situation in the past that many DAs will not prosecute a resisting arrest charge on a parole probation officer because they do not consider them peace officers under the current statutes. House Bill 3379 will make clear this point of contention, and I ask for your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Brian Montgomery. I'm a parole and probation officer with Multnomah County. I'm also a State Police Academy certified firearms instructor. I work as a instructor for our department in use of force and officer survival skills. And I'll talk just briefly about a little bit of the training that we undergo, how similar it is to that of police officers and sheriffs in the state, some of the community safety aspects that we deal with every day. We work hand in hand with other law enforcement agencies constantly. Our jobs are very, very similar in many respects. We have additional tasks and duties that we also perform dealing with treatment, counseling, referral to services, work with DHS, the more social work end of our job. But there is a huge component of our job that is very much law enforcement oriented. And it's no longer a matter of either or, either you're more law enforcement oriented or you are more social work oriented. That does not really apply anymore in today's world of community supervision. Our officers must be able to live and work among a continuum of those types of activities from the more law enforcement oriented all the way up to the social work aspects and do so very quickly. Not just I do my law enforcement stuff when I'm out in the field, I do my social work stuff when I'm in the office. We do both in both places and in many different areas. We undergo what is now a 5-week academy at the State Police Academy, DPSST. They recently added the 5th week for firearms training for all officers. Our department, Multnomah County, we are what we call optionally armed, which means every officer has a choice of whether or not to become armed or not. And most, the overwhelming majority of departments in the state have that option. There are some that just do not have the option. I don't believe that there are any that are mandatorily armed. Most of them have the option. The training for that is identical to that of police officers, sheriffs, going through the academy's 2-week advanced firearms instructor course. I was one of 3 parole and probation officers. The rest were police officers. There was 25 or 30 people in my class. The certification process for that within the state for every officer is a 40-hour course. It's a week-long course. For our department, you must qualify it with 100% proficiency with your firearm before you may be issued that firearm. Those are pretty strict standards, and there's a reason for that. We want to be trained the same as everybody else. It's consistent among all officers in the state. We also undergo annual recertification for defensive tactics, OC spray, pepper spray, tactical baton, handcuffing, arrest procedures, identical, again, to that which police officers go through. I think it's almost an omission that we're not classified as peace officers in the state. Our job has really evolved to the point where you must be proficient in all those things because we do them constantly. I think one of the added benefits to this bill, and please forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn, I'm not sure what the financial implications are. Every community in the state will essentially be adding peace officers to their respective communities at little or no cost to the taxpayers of those communities. So in other words, you have X number of police officers and sheriffs in a community of X number of parole and probation officers. By creating us all peace officers, you've simply added to that, given us additional tools to do our job. To give you an example, if we have an offender who has a warrant, perhaps that warrant was issued in another county before they were placed on supervision or whatever the case may be. It wasn't a warrant that we requested and was issued at our request. According to statute, we should not be serving that warrant because on the warrant it reads any peace officer in the state of Oregon. Well, that puts us in a bit of a gray area because here we have one of our offenders who has a warrant for his arrest, and the question is, do I arrest that person or not? What liability do I have if I do not arrest that person and they go out and commit a crime against somebody? Mm-hmm. What liability do I have if I do arrest that person and I potentially violated some state statute? This would clean that up very easily. This would give us the authority to do that when appropriate. I know there's been some talk, some discussion around about just, it's just going to make us all police officers, and I don't think anything could be farther from the truth. We're not trying to be police officers. We all have the option to go apply any police agency we'd like. We have a specific job with specific duties that are different from any police officer in the state. We will continue to do those job duties just as we do now. We will only be able to do them better, more effectively, and more efficiently given this small change to the Oregon state statute. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Barker and representatives. Thank you for hearing this bill today. My name is Lucinda Carroll. I'm a probation parole officer in Washington County. I supervise approximately 75 domestic violent offenders. I'm here in support of House Bill 3379. And again, to reiterate what he just explained, we had a situation about a month ago where a probation officer was out in the field, was viciously attacked by a dog while the offender and the roommate stood by and watched. They made no effort to take the dogs off her. She was bitten several times severely. That offender has still not been prosecuted by our DA's office. We have not had word whether it's because we're not in that peace officer statute or not, but we think that that would help any district attorney's office file charges against that offender. To this day, the offender is not in jail. He's still out. He received a very short sanction for this. The roommate has not been charged with anything. And if we are placed under this statute, that roommate could be charged with standing by and watching a peace officer be assaulted. So we are definitely in support of this bill, and in many cases we're the last line of defense to the community, and this bill would place us with a lot of protection that police officers currently have, and we hope that you'll support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
If I may, again, Brian Elijah, just one additional clarification. I was a little bit surprised a couple of years ago to realize that in some counties, parole and probation officers are actually deputized. So there are already peace officers in those counties where they're deputized, but in those counties where they're not, or when in the counties that came back to the state, they're not. So there is even inequity between different jurisdictions based upon how their employment status is, whether they're a deputy or whether they're in a separate department.
Mr. Chair, I've got some follow-ups. Brian, you mentioned that. I've been studying this and following with what's going on with parole probations within each county and who the supervisor, the I guess the CEO is, of them, for a better term. And how I know from my counties that I was involved with, Lynn and Benton counties, the sheriff was responsible at one time until recently 1145 kicked parole probation back to DOC down Lynn County. That had to be a little bit of a struggle, having been deputized at one time to perform those duties, and then now all of a sudden being under DOC and not having that authority. How many counties are there that do have that are deputized, do you know, for parole and probation throughout the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I do not know that, but we can get that information. We'll make that attempt. I am familiar that Marion County, I believe, are deputized. Anyone else know? We'll do some research and we'll get back to you on that. But I do know for sure that Marion County is an example of that.
There's some follow-up. Mr. Montgomery, this is more of a question directed towards you from DPSST perspective. You mentioned in your testimony about firearm qualification, or actually what you stated was that you have to be 100% proficiency. What is that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson. In order to qualify to carry a firearm in Multnomah County for the Department of Community Justice, an officer must, what we call cold qualify. you don't get a warm-up. You come to the range, you're prepared, and you go through what is the state's standardized practical qualification course, it's called. It's a 10-yard course. In other words, 10 yards is the longest distance that you shoot from, and it's there are a series of different tasks that you must perform with your firearm. On a standard BPSST target, it's a silhouette roughly in the shape of a human torso, and there's an intersection where all the rounds must hit within specific time guidelines for that course of fire. Any deviation from that, that officer would not be issued a firearm. Now, we do what's called remediate on the spot. We correct any shooter errors, any deficiencies, we address immediately. It's a liability, it's a training issue. That initial qualification, though, must be 100%. If that officer, even if that officer gets every round in where it's supposed to go, if they're 1 second over time in one area, they don't get issued that firearm. The same goes for requalification. Every 4 months, you go through the same process, the same course, the same times. Any deviation, we remediate again on the spot. We go through, we correct those deficiencies.
Follow up on that. Okay, so what's your qualification level then for shooting?
I'm sorry.
At what level do they have to qualify? It's not 100%. I mean, for qualification.
What score do they need on the
Yeah, what target? Score do you have to have?
100%.
Really? That's what DPSST is requiring?
That is for Multnomah County. Okay. Other counties are different. Other police departments are different. I know that. For Multnomah County, 100%.
And just one other follow-up, and this is a real quick question. Do you see, with the expanding of the definition of peace officers for parole and probation, where the expansion for DPSST training might occur?
Thank you, and that's something that the short answer is that's way above my pay grade. Is that a possibility? Absolutely. But again, back to my earlier testimony, we have certain jobs to do. We have certain tasks and duties that we're trained to do, that we're expected to do. Adding additional tasks, additional duties may require additional training. That may come at the DPSST level. That may come at the local level. So I don't have an answer for that. I don't believe it would substantially change the job that we do right now, nor would it add that burden of providing additional training for our officers. I hope that's sufficient.
Mr. Wong, did you talk to Mr. Menace over at UBSST about this?
Representative Barker, at the request of Chair Krieger, I did contact Mr. Menace at DPSST. He informed me that he did not believe that this would be a problem for DPSST, that if they felt that further training was necessary, they were more than happy to provide that. I didn't get an indication from him one way or the other whether he had a sense of whether additional training would be required, but certainly DPSST did not feel it would be unduly burdensome to do additional training.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mary Botkin, Jennifer Cameron, Mark Killian.
I don't know.
And Brennan Mitchell. Go ahead. Oh, okay, already. Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here this morning in support of House Bill 3379, and I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We have the honor of representing a number of parole officers around the state, and especially those who are now working back with the Department of Corrections. I think you've been in the building too long when you've watched folks move from one employer to another employer, back to the other, to their old employer, and maybe back again. But under 1145, these folks who are with me today, Jennifer Cameron and Mark Killian, both moved from their county employment, well, from Department of Corrections to the counties under 1145, and now with the abandonment of the community corrections program in their counties, have moved back to the Department of Corrections. And so I think that it makes more sense for me to be quiet and allow these folks to talk about what this bill will do, what aspects of the bill are most important to them, and what is most critical in doing their job duties. And in response to Representative Olson's question, yes, it is difficult to move into a position where you have less authority than you did. With that, Jennifer and Mark will proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Cameron. I'm a parole and probation officer in Linn County and have been so for 13 years. As Ms. Bodkin stated, I was working for the county, for Linn County, as a parole and probation officer, and in 1997 we transferred to the authority of the sheriff's office and at that time became sworn deputies. For 8 years, we had peace officer authority. We had tools that we were able to utilize that made us more effective and efficient in performing our job duties. In November, those things changed, and we again went under the authority of the Department of Corrections. Since then, certain things have been limited in the definition of us as peace officers. Currently, the law defines a peace officer but omits parole and probation officers from that definition. ORS 137.620 states that parole and probation officers shall have the powers of peace officers in the execution of their duties. However, it lacks clear definition in dealing with other issues in statute that require officers to be peace officers, not have the powers of peace officers. For example, as mentioned in earlier testimony, the crimes of resisting arrest and interfering with a peace officer are not considered to apply to parole and probation officers because POs are not considered to be peace officers. Both statutes state that a person commits those crimes, resisting arrest or interfering, if the person knows the person or officer to be a peace officer. In the performance of our duties, we routinely encounter resistance and interference from both supervised offenders and non-offenders. In cases where POs are arresting an offender, the offender or a non-offender who resists and or interferes with the lawful arrest could not be charged with committing the crime of resisting or interfering. Obviously, this affects public safety. Current law also states that parole and probation officer's scope of authority is limited to offenders on supervision. Therefore, as a parole and probation officer, I am not authorized to arrest or detain supervised. I'm only authorized to arrest or detain supervised offenders for violations specific to their supervision. I do not have the authority to arrest supervised offenders on lawful warrants unless the warrant is related to the offender's supervision. For example, a PO is not authorized to arrest an offender on a new crime warrant, such as a rape, an assault, maybe even as simple as a possession charge. We also do not have the authority to arrest or detain non-offenders when a crime is being committed in the PO's presence. In essence, private citizens have more authority to arrest another person than parole and probation officers. Obviously, this limits our ability to provide public safety and offender accountability. I think Mark has some examples that he can explain to you that we've experienced in performing our duties.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Mark Culane, and I, too, work for Linn County as a parole and probation officer. I'd like to add a piece to what Jennifer just stated, where being not defined as peace officers in a situation where it's resisting arrest and interfering with peace officer in the performance of duties has an impact, and that is in the area of offender accountability. I have experienced and have been told by offenders and non-offenders alike that with this new change that they simply will just send out a regular citizen, non-offender, to run interference for the probationer who is inside a residence or any particular area where we may be trying to visit, do a home contact, or any other business with that offender. A few of the examples that we'd like to address are examples that we have actually have had experience with. Several POs have had encountered these kinds of examples. One is where a PO enters a home where a domestic assault is occurring. The person, suspect could be punching a victim, domestic violence situation. Current restrictions would prohibit the probation officer from stopping that assault or detaining that offender or, correction, detaining that non-offender while waiting for police to arrive. So the assault technically can continue to occur and the suspect could get away. Another example would be where we enter a residence and there's obvious drug activity going on. For example, they're packaging material. There may be children present or may not. The point is that there are oftentimes offenders and non-offenders when this occurs. And this is a commission of a crime that's occurring in our presence. Under the current statute and its interpretation, we will not be able to take any lawful action to detain any of the suspects who are not offenders. Another example which I recently experienced, and I've had probably three or four similar ones in the 8 years that I've been with parole and probation, is where I entered a residence and we come across a 12-year-old runaway female. She was in bed with an adult male. And in the scenario, the example I'd like to give, I'd like to make it a little bit of a different twist where the adult male was not an offender. The runaway was on runaway status through NCIC and LEDS. Anybody who had contact with her via law enforcement was to take her under protective custody. Because we are not defined as peace officers in the interpretation as it is as of now, we would not be able to detain that juvenile female. We could ask her to stick around until police arrive. However, she decided to take off, we would not be able to lawfully detain her. I know if it was my child, I would expect anybody who came across that scenario to do what they can to make sure that my daughter is there when the police get there. Obviously, the risk of letting her go and the liability could be very severe, especially in this day and age. Those are three examples that I would like to give to you. They are, again, like I said, examples that we have personally experienced and on a fairly routine basis.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add just a couple of other points. One of the things that occurs to me as I'm sitting here listening to the officers testify is that they are required to report. So they're mandatory reporters, but they can't arrest. And everybody knows that a parole officer is a great witness, but they can't stop the crime. And most citizens don't know the difference between a badge. They don't understand that these folks only have a badge that does part of the job. So when there's a problem, there's no difference in the perpetrator's view of this individual as a law enforcement, as an official of law enforcement. And it just seems to me that it makes sense for us to extend the same rights and protections to the parole and probation officers that are sort of on the streets every day that we extend to the rest of the law enforcement community.
And if I could, Chair Barker, I'd like to interject. I want it to be clear that we don't want to be police officers. In statute, it talks about parole and probation officers but states that they shall not be active members of the regular police force. It's not about going out and doing police work. It's about being able to have the tools available to us when we're out there going into convicted felons' homes, being able to deal with situations, pending police arrival, things like that. And we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Taylor. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Taylor. I'm the Community Corrections Chief for the Oregon Department of Corrections. I appear here today in that role and also as representative of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, who asked me to speak on their behalf also on this bill. The Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, as you know, represent the 36 counties and actually manage the day-to-day operations of probation and parole. They've examined this bill. Their legislative committee, along with us, has talked about some of the concerns that you've heard today and the ways we might be able to re-examine those or address those. And at this time, they don't feel that the, and nor do we feel that the passage of this bill would help us. We're concerned that the a variety of issues. One, this bill would tend to expand both the training and the policy development that we have to go through. And that brings both a variety of issues concerning when and how we interact with people that are not under our supervision, what are the appropriate stances to take in different situations that we may come across. You've heard a variety of them today. And what shall we do? How will we do that? And then the additional training, because we will be moving into a different type of interaction with citizens. There's also, I think, a desire on our part to look further at what this bill affects, what it actually affects. And I think because we have 36 different ways of interpreting things on occasion, there's some question about what authority we currently have as defined by different county councils and our own attorney general, and what is actually state limiting, what limits us within the law. And some of the characterizations today in the testimony so far, for example, we do know that in a variety of counties, a district attorney does prosecute people for assaulting or failing to being in the way of an arrest, and does treat the probation parole officers as peace officers and follows that statute. So in different jurisdictions, we have a different response to the same action. And we'd like to do a better job, I guess, of gathering that together to have that conversation about what are the real limitations we think the current law places on us. The comment was made about adding peace officers to the community, that actually what this does was multiply the number of peace officers. Over the last 30 years that I've been involved with probation and parole, we've taken a fairly strong, tried to divine a fairly bright line between the management of people that are already convicted and under supervision and the citizens that are out there. And we've tried to maintain the role of probation and parole officers to manage those folks. And some of the considerations we get or special abilities we have that the police do not have come from that authority to be able to manage a specific group of individuals that have conditions of supervision imposed by the court or the board that we are monitoring and managing. There's also the ability, I have the responsibility for both Linn County and Douglas County, the two counties that came back to state operation. And in a recent conversation with Sheriff Burright in Linn County, he was talking to me about this authorization and the ability to arrest people. And he suggested that the sheriff may actually have the ability to grant specific deputization in those areas where we would define clearly what it is in those situations where we want the probation parole officer to have the authority and where we would not want them to have the authority to interact. And we would like, one of the earlier questions by Representative Olson, there are currently 7 counties that are operated by the sheriff, and my expectation would be that in most of those counties they would be deputized. And that's one of those local control issues that comes under 1145 in each county where they feel that that's the best place for those operations to be housed. That's what they do. I guess lastly, what we would like to suggest that is, if the committee would like to review the issue further, feels there are some merits engaged in this, that we would like to at least be able to bring some of those stakeholders together, have a conversation about what we think is currently allowed, what is it the policy currently prohibits, and what is it that in fact we would need to change, and where our clear disagreement lies.
Okay. Questions? I have one on, it would seem to me where some counties do prosecute, some don't, that it would be better to have a uniform policy on that. to protect the people. I mean, I don't know other counties. I'm familiar with Multnomah County primarily. I work pretty closely with the people up there when I was in uniform, and you know, they're very helpful in
yes,
doing the police.
Chair Barker, I think that one of the things we'd like to explore is that a district attorney interpretation or policy, because we clearly have some counties where they have determined they are peace officers and they do prosecute.
Yeah, I have some follow-up or some questions, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, just you've raised a couple interesting points here, because I've had discussion, too, with both Sheriff Swinier down in Benton County as well as Sheriff Burright in Linn County regarding this whole issue, too, and I understand their stance on this whole issue. I'm curious your thoughts. if the sheriff under the structure that's occurring right now with 1145, where you're in charge of the parole and probation out of Linn County, if the sheriff steps up and deputizes them right now under that situation, I mean, is that a possibility, or can that work, or are there restrictions to that?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I'm not, it's clearly an area I'm not well versed in how wide is his authority. What we were specifically talking about was the issue of people coming into the office that have warrants on them.
Mm-hmm.
When you're out in the home visiting circumstance and you find individuals out there that you know have warrants on them that are with your offenders, would we be able to, in fact, incarcerate those people or take them into custody, wait for the sheriff or someone to come? There's always the concern that we have to balance between taking an officer off the road to come do that, but our officers ending up spending the time doing the same work. And so he and I were in that conversation. We didn't go further about how big is the waterfront.
Okay.
Where you you deputize that, right, in those counties, the people are deputized? In your counties?
No.
Or not? Okay.
No, Chair Barker, in Linn County, they were under the Sheriff's Department, and when they moved to 1145, so prior they were deputized. When they came back to the state, we do not have that.
Did they have to go to all the police training, do you know, when they were deputized? Did they go through this, whatever it is, 16 weeks or whatever?
I am not clear on what all they had to go through. One of the POs could tell you specifically what they...
Further question, Mr. Chair. Additionally, Mr. Taylor, you mentioned earlier in your testimony about that this would expand the training to the people. How many people or personnel do you have right now under your direct supervision?
Under my direct supervision, I have 30.
Okay. And that includes the parole and probation from both Douglas and...
That's Linn and Douglas County is what I'm counting in that count.
Okay.
Just the probation parole officers.
So does the 5 weeks that they're receiving right now for training from DPSST, you're considering that in this portion for expanding the training to others? Or?
Yeah, Chair Barker, Representative Wells, what I'm trying to anticipate is the kind of situations we would find ourselves in that we currently don't train for. So in a situation that was brought up, if I'm there in the house and I'm now going to arrest a citizen, what are the additional steps I have to go through to do that? When are my go, no-go decisions? Those are the kind of things I'm talking about. The current training, the five-week training for probation parole officers, and the additional in-office training is specific for what we do and what we have authority to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are we going to a work session?
Well, if you want. Close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 3379.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion to move House Bill 3379 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Roll call, please.
Representative
Kirkland?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And I'll carry that.
I mean, but not
to the floor.
To the floor, yeah.
And we'll probably have Representative Crumb carry that in the full floor, but we'll do that now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do
2235? This is
345. Okay.
We open a public hearing on House Bill 3045. Representative Anderson, Deputy Sousa, and Snyder, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I want to apologize. The staff measure summary I sent out on this bill was related to the bill itself. Yesterday afternoon, very late in the afternoon, I did receive Dash 1 amendments that would replace the bill, and the Dash 1 amendments would add to the crime of aggravated murder the murder of a reserve officer who was killed in the line of duty.
Please go ahead, Parker, members of the committee.
My name is Emery Sousa. I'm a detective with the Josephine County Sheriff's Office, and I'm assigned to their major crimes unit. With me, I have Detective Snyder, who's also a member of the Josephine County Interagency Narcotics Division. We're here today in support of House Bill 3045 to include reserve officers in the definition of police officer. As a member of the major crimes unit of Josephine County, I recently had the unsavory task of investigating two officer-involved shootings, one in which a reserve officer was actually shot. Next to me is the regular reserve officer that was with the reserve officers as they approached a home on a domestic disturbance. As soon as they got out of the vehicle, it was at nighttime. As soon as they got out of the vehicle, they were met with numerous shotgun blasts. One of the shotgun blasts hit the reserve officer in the back as they were running to seek cover. Deputy Snyder next to me was on patrol that evening with the reserve, and he escaped injury himself with a shotgun blast. What I submit to you is that the individuals that we approach every day in our jobs do not know the difference between a reserve police officer and a regular police officer. They take the same actions if they're willing to take their life or attempt to take their life as they would being a full-time officer or a reserve officer. I've had the distinction of being a reserve officer for 3.5 years with Josephine County prior to being hired as full-time, as is Deputy Snyder next to me. He was also a reserve officer. In our small community of Josephine County, I shouldn't say small, it's 1,600 square miles, and at any given time we have three deputies on duty for any shift, and to have an extra body in our cars or on patrol with us is always a comfort and a safety factor for all of us involved in the patrol. Basically, what I'm asking is that we include reserve officers in the definition so they are classified under the aggravated murder or attempted aggravated murder statute to include reserve officers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Travis Snyder. I'm a detective with the Josephine County Sheriff's Office. I've been so employed for the last 5.5 years. Prior to my full-time employment with the Sheriff's Office, I was a reserve officer for approximately 8 months. As Detective Susan mentioned, last December I had a reserve officer riding with me while on standard patrol. We responded as a backup unit to a disturbance. Unfortunately for us, we were the first car there. As we approached the residence, exited our vehicles, the house was completely black as we entered, and as we briefly stood behind our doors to try to adjust our eyes to the darkness after the headlights of the car went off, I heard the front door open. I looked back towards the area of the front door, at which time a shotgun blast came in our direction. The subject fired 7 rounds from 50 feet at my car. Reserve Deputy Tim Cockrum was on the passenger side, and as Deputy Sousa said, as we were turning to seek cover, he was shot in the back. I will say it was dark enough that I could not see the subject that was shooting at us. We were standing behind doors with reflective lettering on them and stars for the Sheriff's Office, which were visible from the suspect's vantage point. The only difference in our department between a reserve officer and a full-time officer is obviously the paycheck that we get. Uniform-wise, the only difference is I wear a gold badge, a reserve officer wears a silver badge. Very unlikely that the suspect in this incident was able to make that distinction. And even when we're on a standard call, people assume that the reserve officers with us are full-time police officers, and they treat them accordingly. I was shocked to hear that the attempted aggravated murder charge was only going to apply to me and not to the reserve deputy who was actually shot. It was only aggravated murder due to the fact that reserve police officers are not covered in the statute. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Gordon Anderson from District 3, Josephine County. I became interested in this a month or so ago when it had kind of a stormy course on the Senate committees, and felt that this really does deserve to be brought back. If you look at the addition of reserve officer to the list of different people who are covered, I think we definitely should be considering bringing the reserve officer in. I think it was very telling this morning when I was speaking to both Detective Souza and Deputy Snyder that Tim was a Tim
Cochran.
Tim Cochran, I'm sorry, who is the reserve officer who was shot in Josephine County. As soon as he was past his injuries, was right back on the job. No pay, but tremendous commitment. And I think that needs to be rewarded. We're seeing a lot of reserve officers who are really giving a lot of time in a county that desperately needs more funds to put more officers on the street. And any way we can reward them by giving them the confidence that the people of Oregon and the people of Josephine County are behind them fully and support them in this way, I think will be beneficial. I would encourage you to move this to the floor, and with a due pass recommendation, I certainly hope that we can pass this through. Senator Atkinson originally carried the bill in the Senate, and he wanted to come and present. I don't know whether he'll be able to get here. He's in another committee, and was having a hard time getting out. So with that, I'll conclude and open any questions.
Well, Detective Souza, you, I've seen there's a procedure if you're involved in a shooting your department has. Are your reserves covered under the same thing? Do they have, like, union protection or whatever, anything like that, or how's that work?
They don't fall under the union protection plan as we are paying members of that. However, they are afforded the same assistance that we do for our full-times. We send them for psychological exams. They go through the exact same thing along with the regular officers. There's no difference. He gets his weapon replaced by the department as well, and also a new vest, as you saw the pictures of his of his vest there, that which perhaps saved his life.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I guess I'd throw this out to the group. How many reserve officers have been killed in the line of duty in the last 30 years since Oregon restored the death penalty?
As a former reserve, and I was the reserve coordinator for Josephine County prior to getting hired as full-time, there was none to my knowledge that I knew of offhand. There have been some shootings where they were injured in the line of duty, but none that were actually killed.
There may have been one in Multnomah County. I remember it seems to me that he wasn't killed. There was somebody got a gun one time and shot into the back of, I believe, a reserve deputy in Multnomah County. And maybe it didn't result in death, but if it didn't, it was like quadriplegic paralysis. Mm-hmm. But I'm not real sure about that one.
Okay. If I may add further, we had another instance just after the shooting with involving Deputy Cochran and Detective Snyder, where another reserve was riding with a regular patrol deputy, attempted to make a routine traffic stop in the middle of the night. For whatever reasons, the suspects decided to flee. A pursuit ensued, and again, numerous shotgun blasts, and the vehicle, the patrol vehicle, took a direct hit to the windshield. And again, I submit that suspect certainly didn't know that there was a reserve officer in that vehicle. He just knew that he was being pursued by the police.
I seem to recall, too, there was a case where the state police had a cadet with them up in Portland.
Right.
Where a guy, there again, not knowing, apparently not being able to distinguish real police from somebody else, ran and shot that young kid that was, because he was in some sort of uniform. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Here, thank you.
Brian? Okay. Well, no, go ahead and bring it up. Brian Lashman and Kelly Sky. I'm sorry, Brian first, yeah.
For the record, good morning again. I'm Brian DeLeichman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I'm not here actually to testify on the Dash 1 amendments, which really is the gut and stuff, and totally deletes my bill, although hearing the testimony, I understand the issue that's being brought up and would have no objections to that. I do have an objection, however, to lines 4 through 7 being totally deleted, and let me first address the main text of the bill. As you're all well aware, and many of you who know me know that I speak very straight, so I'm not going to duck the issues here, but the issue that I run into regularly is an issue when we're dealing with election or political activity. Different organizations in the state, whether it's the chiefs, the sheriffs, or it's the line officers, the Oregon Council Police Association, or the PPA, or the Salem Police Officers Association, routinely go through a process of looking at candidates, whether it's for local elections, state legislative elections, statewide elections, or ballot measures. And in many cases, they make an endorsement. What typically happens then is I get a phone call from the candidate or the ballot measure folks saying, since we've been endorsed, what does that mean? Does that mean money? Does that mean name? You can use the name. Does that mean we can have a picture taken with an officer so it can show to the public in our literature that, in fact, that officer, that group has endorsed our race? And so the process normally goes through that I make a phone call to the local officers from that area and say there's been a request by an endorsed candidate in whatever county, whatever city, to have a picture taken for purposes of promotion of their candidacy. And what typically happens is the officer says, well, I have to check with my chief or my sheriff. And the response almost uniformly comes back and says, no, you can't do that. And the justification is that the uniform is the property of the jurisdiction. And by having a picture taken, even off duty, you're in fact using the property of the jurisdiction for political purposes. My response to that is, I understand that, but then why does the chief or the sheriff get to use their uniform for the exact same purpose? So trying to figure out how to deal with this whole thing, you see the language is in 4 through 7, which doesn't say you can't do it, but says if in fact the chief or the sheriff, each jurisdiction will have a policy, and the policy really needs to be from top to bottom. That if in fact off-duty, any of the members of that force have the ability to use the uniform, have a picture taken for that purpose, that in fact all of the members would have that same right. I find it very interesting that in the number of cases that have come back in which the chief or the sheriff does grant that privilege, it's in the instances where it may be a ballot measure that the chief or the sheriff is also supporting, whether it was some of the ballot measures of the middle 90s dealing with funding and a whole variety of local issues, that, yeah, it was great. Let's get the local police officers out there in front. Let's defeat this measure. But when it comes to individual legislative races or something they may not agree with, then, of course, the same flag raises that it's the uniform, it's the jurisdiction of the property of the jurisdiction. That's the issue. I'm going to lay it right out in front of you. It's no sugar-coated, straight out. So I'm open to any questions.
Any questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chair, and I realize, Mr. Lashman, that you're here speaking on the original bill and that the gut and stuff amendment is just off there in left field, but I see a potential connection between the two in this sense. Are the reserve officers who the Dash 1 amendments would add to the aggravated murder statute, are they always in uniform and when they're performing that duty, so that the person who does the killing knows that he's killing a police officer or a peace officer, I guess I would say.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I'm not aware of situations in which a reserve officer, when they're out patrolling, is not in uniform. That may be the case, but I'm not aware of that. And I think the point that was very valid of the two officers were up here was when the bad guy shoots and they see uniform, they don't in their mind make a distinction.
Right. That guy's got a silver badge. That guy's got a gold badge. They don't make that distinction. They're shooting to be shooting, and with obviously the bad guys getting, I think, for lack of a better term, badder out there, and the meth problem and the situations going on out there, I can understand their frustration. And I have no problem with the Dash 1s. I have a problem with the Dash 1s deleting the main body of the bill.
Follow up, Mr. Beck. Good, Mr. Chair. Recognizing that you wouldn't favor a gut and stuff, how do you feel about a stuffing without the gut? Given that the Dash 1 amendments would introduce into the bill an aggravated murder death penalty kind of issue in what is otherwise a bill that's directed at something completely different, and it seems to me very worthwhile, and it just stirs issues that are potentially quite controversial into that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, having not followed this on the Senate side, it's my understanding from the testimony that this issue was raised in the Senate side and didn't get full play or eventually went down. If this amendment were to add that as an element that could draw down my bill on the Senate side, I obviously would have that concern. But given that both chambers may have their idea of what's right, what they should do, if it were added in this side, obviously the Senate could, in fact, take that portion out if they didn't agree with that, and then we'd be in conference committee. So there's still some area for dialogue. I would leave it at your pleasure. My preference would be a clean bill. If this is the only vehicle that this particular issue can be added to, and it's a stuff and stuff, an add-on, I'm not going to stand in your way. But again, the Senate would have the opportunity again to look at the issue.
I was thinking one other thing about the uniforms and the similarities. And when Multnomah County, before they set up the security to prevent any other guns from coming in the building, there were some judges wanted police to, you know, put their gun in a locker or something, and I was always greatly concerned that a bad guy wouldn't be looking to see whether or not, you know, you had a gun or not, if they were going to start shooting at a uniform. But Multnomah County is kind of a different world. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I understand with the three officers or retired officers on this, they understand what we're talking about when they're talking about the bad guys out there.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Atkinson. Thank you for coming over.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Jason Atkinson. I represent the left field, stovetop stuffing, and occasionally Southern Oregon. Thank you for having me. I'm in another committee, so I apologize for not getting here at the beginning. Just in brief, I do support the Dash 1 amendments. I think this is a very important issue, and certainly at the indulgence of the committee, and also at the thanks of Representative Anderson for using a priority bill to get this issue heard, will take whatever form you'd like to, if you'd see fit to amend in the Dash 1s to work on the Senate side. I do believe that the bill would come to my committee and the Rules Committee, at least I hope, and where it can be worked on there. I think there's some very large issues facing law enforcement, as all of you know, probably far greater than I, but in Josephine County, this is where this did come to my attention, where we have got a significant amount of budget shortfalls, but we have, as you just said, a very large growth of the bad guys getting worse, especially as it relates to meth. And so one of the things that was very troubling to me where I got involved in this issue is simply because we're asking people to go out and enforce a law, but the law is not behind them. Certainly, there's a whole range of issues here when you're looking at the penalty phase if a crime like this were to be incurred. And I'm very flexible to work with all of you. I just think that as a statement of policy, if someone is going to harm a peace officer, I don't think, as Representative McPherson pointed out, I don't believe that there's going to be a distinguishable conscious thought between a gold badge and a silver badge. So with that, I would be delighted to answer any questions, but I did want to come and just add my support and thanks to the committee.
Okay, questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Kelly Sky.
Good morning.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose, we didn't have a position on the original bill, 3045, we do oppose the Dash 1 amendments because it does constitute an expansion to the death penalty. And I want to be clear that we're not here objecting to this because we see a distinction between a police officer and a reserve officer. We're merely objecting because it is an expansion to the death penalty, and we object to the death penalty, its existing provisions, and absolutely any expansion to it. We would urge you to resist the temptation to expand the death penalty every time a different interest or a different case comes about that wants to be included in the death penalty or in the aggravated murder statutes, because every session there will be somebody who can present a case or an interest that on its face looks like a logical addition to the aggravated murder statutes. And we already have 18 separate provisions that can place you within the provisions of the aggravated murder statute, and we would not like to see those expand. And what I'm talking about, I think actually, Chair Barker, you alluded to a murder of a cadet. So, you know, if we're looking at...
They wounded him. Actually, he was just wounded.
I'm sorry?
He was just wounded. He didn't, that cadet didn't die.
Oh, okay. But my point being that you may, next session, have someone come in and say, well, you know, this person shot this other person because they thought they were a police officer. So we should add in a provision that anybody who thinks that someone is a police officer, and then anybody who thinks that someone is a witness in an offense. And you can see how it just expands and expands and expands. What we really need to be doing is looking at ways to reduce our use of the death penalty, not expand it. It's incredibly expensive. It's the most expensive part of our criminal justice system, and the cost-benefit analysis doesn't prove that it's an effective use of our funds. We are not executing people who are on death row. However, we're spending a tremendous amount of money prosecuting and defending and incarcerating individuals on the aggravated murder cases. So we would ask you not to expand the death penalty.
Questions? Thank you. Close the public hearing. Move to a work session. We'll go back to public hearing. I'm sorry, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman, I didn't come prepared to debate the death penalty nor the original bill, but I find myself maybe doing both. First, on the death penalty side, my sense is that inadvertently this particular classification of law enforcement is left out of the bill. So the policy decision has already been made. The Dash 1 amendments just make it consistent, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association wholeheartedly supports that. On the other hand, we wholeheartedly oppose the original bill and would oppose the stuff in this situation. We would be required to oppose the bill. Use of endorsement authority and uniform carries with it more than just the individual in the picture. A sheriff is an elected official. A person responsible for the budget, in many cases passing a budget locally. And with all of those responsibilities, it is imperative that the image of the sheriffs and the sheriff's department be under the control of the person who is leading that organization. Kevin Campbell couldn't be here today, but would also say the same thing for the Chiefs Association.
Except the Chiefs aren't elected, but
right.
Any questions?
Well, I do have a question about that, Mr. Chair. It looks to me like the thrust of the bill is simply to have a uniform in two senses of the word, uniform policy as to all persons in the department about the wearing of uniforms. So what about that is troublesome?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, When it comes to, as I understand the intent of the bill, is if endorsements can be made, they can be made by anybody then in their uniform.
It would
have to be the same for...
If the sheriff was in uniform, then the deputy could be doing it.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we'll close the public hearing and move to a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 345.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Well, actually,
discussion.
Yeah, let me discuss that. I do think that there's a reasonable principle stated in the original bill, and so I do object to the gut and stuff aspect of the dash one amendments. So I'll register an objection to that. Okay. Now, I realize I didn't get that done before you rang the bell then.
That's all right. Well, recognize that objection. We'll have a vote on the amendments.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Okay, the amendments are adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendments with House Bill 345. To the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Let me just offer up a comment. Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote for the bill, but I want to explain that vote. I am concerned about the point that was made by Ms. Guy that every session, we're bound to have folks come in who are looking to expand in some way by working off of the existing categories and trying to identify some illogic to the way they work and looking to always be expanding. And it would be an interesting exercise if somebody would come in and ask to narrow the aggravated murder statute because of some aspect that's gotten a little overly broad. We certainly invite them if they to do so wherever they see an illogic. In this particular instance, I do agree with what John Powell said, that the policy choice has been made, and it's really just clarifying that people who are side by side with the regular police officers are within that statute, and on that basis, I'll support the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Okay, I'm going to call for a real quick 5-minute recess. Bill 2335. Don.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for State Representative Jerry Crummell. And you have the dash fours with you today, House Bill 2335. You may remember this bill from a few months ago. We brought in Kathy and Keith Scott, a family from Klamath Falls, to explain their situation. And we have a couple of companion bills over in Human Resources, Health and Human Services Committee, and their subcommittee working on child protection, child abuse cases. And we've heard similar stories to the Stotts since then. And so we, at the suggestion of Chair Krieger, put together a work group to work on the amendments to this bill to make it a better bill, if you will. And you'll notice that as you look through the amendments, we've made quite a few concessions. And just so you know, I wanted to thank the committee for allowing us to do that with the work group and the members of that work group, the folks who were invited, state police, the DPSST, John Minnis, the director himself was there, Mark Landauer from the city of Portland, Kevin Campbell's been a big help on this with the chiefs of police, John Powell of the Sheriff's Association, and a number of others have been involved in this. And we've had similar versions of this amendment out circulating for several weeks now to the District Attorneys Association and to other groups. And so basically, let me recap what these amendments would do. Instead of the 45-day window that you saw in the original bill, we doubled that to 90 days. And instead of the police agencies being the only ones to take the full focus of the investigation, it would now go to the MDTs, the local multidisciplinary child abuse team, and then they would look at all the factors that are going into the investigation and come back within that 90 days to determine the following three things: whether the investigation should continue, whether any other children or adults in the family, the placement situation for those folks, and then looking at the timeline of when the investigation might be completed. So you really get a broader perspective, and you get the MDT helping you move this any particular case along. We also added some immunity from liability in there for the various police agencies, and we do have John Powell and Brian DeLashmet here today who are supportive of the amendments, as well as Kevin Campbell could not be here today, but he is he's looked them over, and he's happy with the way they turned out. I know the district attorneys have some heartburn over the MDT getting perhaps overwhelmed with the number of cases, but again, these amendments have been out there for the DAs to review for several weeks since the first we're hearing of that. Secondly, if you look at the language in Section 2 of the amendments, the MDTs would only be getting the cases where you have a child or an adult being removed from the home, and I'm not sure what percentage of all the cases that the police investigate where that's considered. Maybe, you know, a third. I'm just kind of throwing a ballpark at that. So, I mean, if we want to look at changing that language and narrowing that down to where those investigations might have a more narrow focus in extreme cases, perhaps we can also look at amendments over on the Senate side. But for now, Representative Crummell would like to work on the language we have here. We believe it's a good compromise. We've worked with all the parties on this who've been involved in the work group from day one. This is actually the fourth set of amendments, so that we tried to make everyone happy with it, and I'm available for questions.
Okay, I just would say I hadn't seen the dashboards until this morning, so I have a chance to look at them.
Were any DAs from the Oregon District Attorneys Association part of the work group?
No, because when the work group met, it was strictly based on should the investigation stay within the police realm. And once they started talking about it, they wanted to involve the MDTs. And so at that point, they felt it was important to send the amendments, and we sent the dash ones to the DAs to get their input on it and ask them to get back to us if they had any problems, and we didn't hear anything back, so we assumed they were okay with it.
Was that, I mean, when you say the DAs, who did you send it to?
Just Bob Herman, who I believe is the president of the DAs Association for this legislative session. And he's also the Washington County District Attorney. Representative Crummell does have a substantial chunk of his district in Washington County.
Okay.
A question, Mr. Chair. Don, could you or did you send it possibly to Bradbury down Yamhill County DA's office?
No, I don't believe we did.
You guys have part of that too, don't you?
No, we don't. We have Clackamas and Washington County.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead. Hey, Don, please. You said there was a similar amendment floating around for several weeks, but the dash fours are new today, obviously. So what's the difference between the similar previous amendment and this one?
The main change that you'll see, and I think John could probably back me up on this, in the original bill, lines 27 through 29 on page 1 of the original bill had that 45-day language in it. And the police agencies felt it was important to take that out and use the 90-day language that we're using now in the dash fours. So that was the main change in the dash fours.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first of all, I just want to thank Representative Crummell for being amenable to changing the bill. The bill is introduced, required law enforcement to complete their investigation in these cases in 45 days. And in many cases, that's impossible to do. The labs, for example, the state police, for DNA samples are backed way up. Many times it can take 30 days or 60 days to get a test done. So it's literally impossible to meet that kind of a deadline. This bill and the amendments before you change that to a broader scope, and Representative Crummell's trying to raise the profile of these cases simply because the allegations made and the seriousness of those allegations when somebody's been removed from the home, the lives of this family have been shattered. And at least Representative Crummell believes that the agencies involved, law enforcement and others, should do their utmost to
take that into consideration as they're proceeding with these investigations. And so this 90-day review by the multidisciplinary team would require them simply to get together and review some of those bigger questions about this case. We're all busy in our lives, and so are these people. And this would give them kind of a chance in this investigation to stop and take stock of where they are in that investigation, look at the issues, and consider the welfare of all the people involved in the case, and go from there. It does not require them to take any specific action based on that, but it requires them to review the case in that way. And so that's the agreement that our work group came to.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
I have a question, Mr. Powell. Do you know what agencies are represented on a multidisciplinary team in any given county?
Mr. Chairman and staff, I don't know. I know that the teams are created by statute and are required in each county, but I do not know what agencies participate. I know the DA, the law enforcement agency, the family agency that's involved at least, but I do not know if there are others in addition to that. I was quite frankly unaware that every county had one of these teams until this issue came up.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Gina Skinner.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, my name is Gina Skinner, representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. I primarily came today to testify on the previous bill that I testified on, and I spoke with Mr. Sparks, who apparently was before your committee previously and testified on this bill. I am not ready to give a position from the District Attorney Association on the Dash 4 amendment since they just came out this morning, and it's possible that we would be amenable to them. I wish that we would have participated on the committee or the work group, and we did not, and so I don't feel I'm in a position that I can give a position one way or another about. I know that we have a meeting this Thursday, and I'd be more than willing to present this issue to our committee and to come with an official position based on the Dash 4 amendments to this bill. The only thing that I can say is we do have, from discussions we've had in the past, concerns about not only the timelines and the ability to have a thorough investigation, but also the concerns about overwhelming MDTs, especially in smaller counties, that this would be a significant amount of work that they would be required by this statute to complete, and that may or may not be possible. But like I said, I would like to have an opportunity to present this to our committee and be able to have a formal position on the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay. Any questions?
And Mr. Chair, and this really isn't a question for Ms. Skinner, but more it's a comment that the Dash 4 amendments look a lot more palatable than what we were looking at in the original bill, and I really would like to get input from the DA's Association. I think that's pretty important input, because their perspective on this would be quite very valuable to have.
Thank you. By way of comment, too. You certainly don't want the families hanging out in limbo and somebody being pulled out and the expense of having to set a separate residence and all that. And just the huge trauma that would cause to a family. That being said, I don't want some kid that's been abused to get caught up in some kind of a timeline, artificial timeline that we're imposing, and that she be returned or he be returned to a home where there's abuse. And then they give up and decide there was no sense in complaining because nobody will believe me anyway. The act, the crime, of especially the sexual molestation in the home, is one of the just kind of like super evil to me. And I want to protect those kids, as I know everybody, including Representative Crummell, does. And therefore, I'm going to believe, close the work session today, and we need some more input before this is ready to go.
Chair Barr, I just want to make a comment. It says no later than 90 days after receiving the notification described above where they're removing the family member, that it's just merely reviewed by the team.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that, I don't see that.
Okay. I know it doesn't mean they'll lose, they would automatically dismiss it or anything.
It's better to verbiage than it was before.
It's absolutely better than the last time. But I'm going to close the work hearing on this today. We'll get back to it again. We're sure not done with it. And is there any further business before the committee today? Adjourned.